everyone. This is the Stark Truth on Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Robert Stark. My guest tonight is Kevin McDonald. It's nice having you on. Your most recent article up at the Occidental Observer is about this. It's about this article by Lee Siegel in the Wall Street Journal. And first of all, can you explain who Lee Siegel is?
Well, he's a big-time journalist, and I actually written a previous article about him. He'd written this thing in the New York Times, in this case, about Romney, and basically saying how white Romney was. And he had a big photo of Romney's family. You know, he's got a big family. He's got a lot of brothers, sisters, children, and nephews, nieces, and so on. So he had this big white family, and they're all looking healthy and good-looking and rich. And Lee Siegel was just, you know, that was like the image from hell for him. Yeah, he was just horrified by it. And so that struck me. And so I blogged about that. And then now he's got this article, you know, sort of bragging about, you know, Jewish dominance in the media and expressing sort of concern or interest, in, at least in the fact that Asians are this new rising elite. So he sees, possibly a conflict between Jews and Asians in the future.
And that article is called A Rise of the Tiger Nation.
Right, right. But in doing so, he talks about Jewish, that Jews sort of ended up overcoming WASP domination. He talked about the WASP mandarinate, you know, and of course, from his point of view as a Jew, he accuses them of being mean and trying to keep out Jews and all that. And now he actually is thinking, you know, well, is it possible that Jews would prevent themselves from being displaced by this new rising elite? And I totally agree that I think Jews will protect themselves from being dislodged. But I don't really think that Asians are going to compete with Jews as far as a sort of media elite goes. I don't see Asians really gravitating toward the media anyway. But what's most interesting to me was simply his acknowledgement of Jewish domination. I mean, that's really what it amounted to. And you don't see that very often. Usually, in fact, the ADL often takes pains to resist any suggestion that Jews have any kind of influence in our society at all. And now we have a Jewish writer. And this is not the first time. There's another article I wrote not long ago, again by a Jewish writer. This time, I believe, he was in Jewish, small-time Jewish magazine, and, based in New York or something. And also, you know, stating, you know, we just basically run this country now, and what are the implications of that? And so it's nice to see this, but at the same time, Siegel and this other writer won't say what I think is obviously true, that Jewish domination is not good for the traditional white population in this country. I mean, I think that's the big issue. If that's, from their point of view, the rise of the Jews is all about the fact that Jews are more talented and this and that, but they never really talk about conflicts of interest, that Jews have very different interests in the construction of culture. And in particular, Jews have been, you know, strong advocates of non-white immigration. They've been strong advocates of multiculturalism. They've been strong advocates of the idea that Christianity or the traditional white population has any claim to sort of, you know, historical precedence in this country and should be allowed to continue as a majority and so on. Those are the kind of things that are absolutely anathema to this Jewish elite. So that's the kind of stuff is left out. I mean, when someone like Siegel talks about it, it's all, you know, ethnic pride that we overcame these evil WASPs, but never wanting to talk about the fact that, you know, the policies of Jews have favored have very much discriminated against the traditional people of America.
So he's sort of makes it into a morality tale.
Yeah, I'd say that's right. Yeah. On the one time, you know, the good news is he acknowledges that Jews are an elite. And, you know, I've been raked over the coals many times for saying exactly that. You know, I mean, to me, it's sort of obvious when you think about media ownership and you think about, the academic world and some of these Jewish intellectual movements that have been so influential. When you think about the Israel lobby and its influence on our foreign policy. For example, one of the examples I have in the article is, if you think about apartheid, you know, beginning in the 1960s or so, anti-apartheid crusades were just a huge thing in Western countries. I don't think you could name a Western country that wasn't completely opposed to apartheid, which was really by their own, you know, people down in Africa. But now the fact of Jewish apartheid in Israel is simply not on the public radar. And it's interesting, Justin Romando, I cite this article in my article. He had an article recently about Israel pointing out that a recent survey, 58% of Israelis acknowledge that Israel is an apartheid society. Well, you know, that's just not talked about in America. Israel is our little embattled democracy in the Middle East. It's our biggest ally, our friend, and all that. That's all we get. But in reality, the values of the Israeli political establishment are diametrically opposed to the political establishment in this country, and certainly to the organized Jewish community in this country. I mean, they're opposite to what the organized Jewish community pushes in this country. You know, and in this country, the organized Jewish community is completely in favor of immigration, whether it's legal or illegal. In Israel, they're very much in favor of immigration restriction over there, and the American Jewish community doesn't say a word about it. So there's huge gaps. I mean, the Israeli government now is the most right-wing it has ever been in its history. And they recently announced this big join together of the Likud party with Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman's party. So this is going to be very much of a Jewish nationalist government in Israel. They're not going to have any compunctions about getting rid of immigrants. They've already got walls going up, and they're expelling immigrants and so on. So, of course, the American Jewish community, very much in favor of that kind of stuff when it's in Israel, but not when it's in this country, because it's simply not in their interest.
So you talk about how the WASP, they resisted this by establishing quotas at Ivy League universities. And some of this, that was ended in the 50s, right after World War II.
Yeah, I think in general that's what happened. And you know, up before World War II, there was actually quite a lot of anti-Semitism in this country. And actually, Siegel talks about that a little bit. He talks about the fact that Jews were associated with radicalism. There's no question that's the case. Jews were the backbone of the far left in this country. Communism, it was sort of well known that Jews had a very prominent position in the Bolshevik Revolution, that they were very prominent in the Soviet Union. They were prominent on the far left in this country and just about everywhere. So that was part of the stereotype of Jews in those days, and it was a very negative stereotype. But after World War II, all that fell apart, and Jews were, you know, pretty much admitted to whatever, you know, these elite universities. And then they became, you know, vastly overrepresented. Even with the quotas, they were overrepresented on the basis of their population. But after the World War II, they became dramatically overrepresented. So now it's about 20-25%.
Well, you're saying now it's about 25-30%. I was going to ask you, do you think it was more because of right after World War II, or the whole movement that came out of the 60s, or a combination of both?
Yeah, probably a combination of both. I think Jewish power has continued to increase, but certainly one of the watershed periods for the rise of Jewish power was the 1960s. And that's the time when, the sort of political left came to the fore with the youth movement in the 1960s, which I actually participated in. But it's very clear, I was at the University of Wisconsin, and this was very, very much of a Jewish movement. The people who were leading it were from New York, they were Jewish. The 1960s was a watershed. You had the civil rights movement. Jews were very much involved in that. You had the anti-Vietnam War movement, which was a huge Jewish movement. But most important of all, ultimately, was the immigration law of 1965.
Vietnam War, but they were mostly on the anti-war side, because usually what you talk
very
about
much on the anti-war
is
the, side.
How they've been on the pro-war side.
But what about the pro-war side?
with the Vietnam War, because there's a lot of talk about with the current war in Iraq and the neoconservative policies and World War II, of course, but with the Vietnam War, you're saying they were staunchly anti-war.
That's right. And, you know, certainly that was obvious in the youth movement, but even the mainstream Jewish organizations were opposed to the war. And there was a famous quote from Lyndon Johnson. I don't know exactly what he said, but it's something like, you know, we support Israel and all this stuff. Why don't you support us in the war in Vietnam? It was like, you know, he was upset about that because there was a pretty much of a unified Jewish hostility towards the war in Vietnam. But now, as you say, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iran, which I think there's going to be a huge campaign for this war early next year after the election settled and everything, and we see who's president and all that. There's going to be a massive campaign for America to go to war against Iran. There was already a pretty much of a campaign, but that sort of died down. I do think the Obama administration stood up to the Israel lobby, but I really think that when push comes to shove here, I think that they're going to put on pressure that you can't believe in the next year.
So you're there. So for the election, they're sort of keeping it. Well, Romney's talked about it in the debates. I mean, he's more pretty much explicit about his policies, but I think Obama's keeping his views kind of low key until after the election.
Yeah, I'd say that's right. But you know, early on, Romney was gung-ho for a war, and he was very explicitly in favor of you know sucking up to these neocons. He had prominent neocons in his foreign policy entourage and so on. But he sort of backed off on that, and he started to make contact with the so-called realist school in the Republican Party, George Shultz, for example. I think he started to think that the really, you know, gung-ho war thing with Iran was not a winner at the election. So in the foreign policy debate, he did not accentuate any differences in policy towards Iran between him and Obama. I think he realizes that the American people don't really want this. They're not going to vote for a candidate on the basis that he's going to really, really tough on Iran and wants to bomb them into the Stone Age or something like that. So I think he – but having said that, I do think that after the election when we're going to see enormous pressure, we may see incidents, that provoke the war, like, you know, some kind of armed skirmish or a boat being sunk or something like that, to provoke war. We may see false intelligence reports like we saw with the war in Iraq. So we'll see what happens, but there's no question that the Jewish lobby wants this desperately. And I don't think that Israel thinks that they can, you know, carry out this war by itself. But they want to punish Iran, and they want to punish it. In my opinion, I think they want to go beyond just getting rid of nuclear weapons. I think they want to punish Iran. They want to set Iran back as far as possible. They want to make the people suffer as much as possible.
So it's there's different theories. One is that Iran's a geopolitical threat to Israel, but a lot of it is just more about they're just personally offended by a lot of the stuff that Iran's government has said. You think that's the reason?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, Iran supports Hezbollah, for example. And so they've been staunchly on the side of the Palestinians. So Hezbollah has a lot of arms that are supplied by Iran. They've got their bases in Lebanon. Israel sees Iran as just a thorn in their side, as something that it goes way beyond nuclear weapons.
So you think it's mainly the geopolitical issue?
Yeah, right now, you know, the only real power in the world that's really arrayed against them is Iran. So they want to take out Iran. I mean, they want to set it back a decade or whatever. In the same way that, you know, in 2003, they decided to go after Iraq. Actually, I think the Israeli government or a lot of people in Israel wanted us to go after Iran back then. They viewed Iran as a bigger threat. But it worked out that it was Iraq instead. This time around, I do believe it's going to be Iran. I don't think they've given up. And we'll see a huge pressure beginning next year.
So back to the article by Lou Siegel. He sort of describes that kind of opposition. He uses terms of about like toxic or racism and some of the things we're pointing out.
Oh yeah, he's you know, his point of view is that white people are horribly racist. They're evil, and he's cognizant of the fact that they've sort of won, but he views it as this sleeping giant that might awaken at any moment and destroy everything. So from his point of view, and I think this is the thinking behind of the organized Jewish community, they want to get as many non-whites in the country as fast as they can, because they're still concerned that there's going to be a backlash. Ultimately, that there's a lot of anger, that you have the displacement of the entire population is ultimately what's going to happen here.
And do you think that they're correct in that concern of a backlash?
Well, I would, in a way, I'd like to think that, because that implies that white people would stand up, that they would say, hey, we have interest. There's no law in the universe that we have to sort of cede political power, that we should admit these millions and millions of people who are all voting for the Democratic Party. I mean, you see increasingly racialized political landscape in America, where the Democratic Party is the party of non-white America. And so all these immigrants are coming in, and we have no obligation to want this. I mean, one of the most amazing things about this election is there has not been one word from either candidate about legal immigration. And yet, isn't that astounding? I mean, you've got over a million people coming to this country legally every year. And our economy is struggling to keep up. I mean, it's interesting. Today, they said that there are 170,000 new jobs. But they also said in order to keep up with the population, they have to have 150,000 new jobs.
There was a study that came out that said two-thirds or even more of the new jobs went to immigrants, legal and illegal, that Obama created.
Exactly. You know, so it's, you know, and the thing is, this is such a sacred cow that maintaining diversity and continuing this policy is more important than anything. It doesn't matter what the interests of the United States are. It is irrelevant what the interests of the traditional people in this country are. This is what you see, I think, when you have a domination by an elite. Their issues become sacred cows, just like with Israel. It's a sacred cow. You can't attack it. You can't point out about apartheid. You can't talk about ethnic cleansing going on over there. You can't talk about our foreign policy being dominated by concern about this little country and this very small minority in our country. Those become the sacred issues. You can't talk about the Wall Street financial scandals and talk about Jewish involvement there. Those people are not going to be prosecuted. This is what happens when you have an elite. They become above the law, and you can't talk about their interests. So that's really what's going on here. So immigration can't be discussed. It's simply off the charts. So we just keep going this way, this direction, because that's the way they want it to go. From their point of view, making a minority white America is the most important thing there is. And nothing else is important. It doesn't matter what the unemployment rate is, it really doesn't matter. Anything else, that has to continue. And so that will never be brought up, it'll never be discussed, it won't, you know, even back and forth. You won't see an honest debate in the newspapers between, say, representatives from the Center for Immigration Policy, which put out that report about jobs and immigration. You won't see them taking a point of view in the newspapers and then somebody opposing it. No, that it just won't even be discussed.
I think that study wasn't a mainstream newspaper. I think it was the Washington Post, if I'm not 100% certain.
Well, it comes from the Center for Immigration Policy, which is a very good thing, very good organization. I don't know what media outlets they were managed to get their articles in, but their press releases in, but the fact is it hasn't come up either political campaign. It's not discussed in Congress anymore. Immigration policy is on autopilot, and there's just simply beyond. It's a sacred cow, literally, can't be discussed.
Or if they do with the conservatives, they'll talk about it, but they'll just talk about illegal immigration and not legal immigration.
Exactly. I mean, you tune on Hannity on Fox or Rush Limbaugh once in a while. They'll talk about illegal immigration. It's far from their big priority. It's almost you feel that you listen to Limbaugh. In fact, I do recall when the Bush administration wanted to have some amnesty, and there was a grassroots movement, really impressive grassroots movement against it. Only then did Rush Limbaugh start talking about it. It's like he would never take the lead on that. And I don't think Hannity cares about it either, any of these so-called mainstream conservatives. They will talk about it once in a while because their constituency is in favor of it. But, yeah, the only one that really was focused on it was Lou Dobbs, and they got rid of him. They got him fired from CNN.
And didn't Lou Dobbs, he kind of sold out on the issue later on.
And then he sold out, yeah. I mean, he kept talking about his Mexican wife and stuff, and he's back on the air now, I guess, on Fox. But, yeah, there was huge pressure to get rid of him. And the Southern Poverty Law Center was part of that, and I'm sure other activist groups were doing what they could. But that's the thing, that the mainstream media is absolutely policed for any point of view that gets too edgy on illegal immigration and even illegal immigration. And legal immigration can't even be discussed. I mean, you'll never see Sean Hannity talk about legal immigration or Bill O'Reilly or those guys, Rush Limbaugh. None of them, not ever once will they talk about that. Even though their constituents, you pull the audience of Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity, they don't want a non-white America. But they never hear these points of view from their spokespeople. Rush Limbaugh speaks for a lot of people. He has a huge audience. But his audience will never hear anything about how legal immigration is destroying the country, how our economy can't possibly create that many jobs. And not to mention all the other costs, in terms of, the political division and the conflict and so on, the political alienation, all the costs of multiculturalism that the research has shown, those things are off the table. And that's how you can tell that this is a policy that is promulgated by elites that's pretty much above any kind of criticism or having to even defend their beliefs anymore.
So with Lou Siegel, what are some of his concerns about Asians? I know he was critical of Amy Chua's book called The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother.
Yeah, I thought that was sort of interesting because, he's seeing these Asians as this rising elite, and in certain terms of education, that's the case. And so this woman, Amy Chua, writes a book about these Asian mothers and the tiger mother where, you really have high expectations for your children. You really drive them hard. And, as a Jew, he's thinking, well, these people are getting way too much like Jews, where they really value ambition. So part of my article was on simply the fact that there's this history of Jewish intellectuals sort of trying to argue that any kind of ambition on the part of white Americans is indication of psychopathology. This goes back to the Frankfurt School, one of my chapters. And so there's a long history where Jews have tried to paint any ambition on the part of white Americans as pathology and linked to all kinds of bad stuff and unhealthy and all that. Whereas Jews themselves have been incredibly ambitious and incredibly driven to excel and to get to the top of the heap and extreme. In fact, Lee Siegel talks about their sort of hyper competitiveness, that they're extremely competitive. Well, yeah, they're into upward mobility, but all of a sudden he's sort of complaining about this Chinese mothering producing upwardly mobile Chinese kids. So it's hypocrisy, but it's par for the course, I guess.
But is he kind of a generally I haven't really seen that much hostility towards Asians among Jews in general.
No, in general they've welcomed Asians. They've welcomed every non-white group. I don't think that Asians are going to be a threat to Jews because they're going to occupy different niches. I think the Jewish niche is they're very verbal. So they're going to dominate the areas like the media, the legal profession, some of the areas of the academic world, having to do with verbal IQ, whereas the Asians are much more what we call performance IQ, much more dealing with spatial issues and more suited to engineering and that kind of stuff. So you're going to have, in fact, in culture critique in the last chapter, I made a prediction that ultimately America would have this Asian media academic, legal elite, and they have an Asian technocratic elite. And so you're seeing all these Asian kids that are going into computer science, they're going into engineering.
And currently, the thing that's important to point out is those things like engineering and science have been, so those haven't necessarily been traditionally Jewish-dominated industries.
Not at all. I mean, you see the Jewish engineers sometimes, but they have not dominated engineering at all, like they have, their influence in the legal profession, or in the, much less the media or financial industry or something like that. Those are the areas that Jews have always gravitated to, the media, the financial industry, and areas of the academic world that have a lot of verbal input, like the social sciences and the humanities. Not so much the technical areas. I mean, they're famous, like Einstein, and all that. But in general, physics and hard sciences have not been dominated by Jews anywhere near the extent to which other areas. And it hasn't been a priority of Jews. They're just not attracted to, say, engineering. They're going to be the guy that runs the company that employs engineers or something. They're not going to be engineers typically. It's a different kind of intelligence. The Asians are more towards spatial IQ. Jews, I think, are more oriented towards verbal IQ. Very different kind of thing.
What about on Wall Street and finance?
Well, I think Wall Street and finance has been an area of Jewish. That Jews have gravitated to, no question about it. And in fact, in the article, Siegel talks about the displacement of WASP elites in the legal profession, but there was similar displacement of WASPs in the financial profession. And there was a huge rise of the Jews, especially in the 1980s, I would say, but, continuing, even, Henry Ford commented on Jews in the financial industry back in the 1920s. That the Jews were trying to buy up all the seats on the stock exchange and so on. So it's a long history, and Jews have always been involved in financial issues, things like, in the old days, money lending and all that. So, you go back to the 19th century, the Rothschilds, the big Jewish money has always been in finance and, lending money and that kind of thing. Huge fortunes, Goldman Sachs is a paradigmatic Jewish company in America. And they are the most successful financial company, and very much involved in the Wall Street scandals of the a few years ago. And they were also involved in scandals at the time of the Great Depression, the stock market crash, and all that in the 1920s. They have a long sordid history, actually, but no question that Jews have dominated that. And you look at the Federal Reserve, the last I don't know how many chairmen of the Federal Reserve have been Jewish. So there's almost an expectation that when the president appoints chairman of the Federal Reserve, it'll be a Jewish guy. And if you look at the board, the Federal Reserve board, very disproportionately Jewish. So it's just an area that they have gravitated to, that they have dominated, really. Look at hedge fund management, that kind of thing, very much of a Jewish industry. So those are the areas that Jews specialize. You don't see Asians really dominating in those areas. Or even gravitating to them now. You see them going into medical research or engineering or something like that, and they're just not oriented to that.
Or I was saying, I'm at Silicon Valley.
Yeah, there are some. If you look at some of the big companies, though, Google is a Jewish company, Oracle, Microsoft is sort of a Jewish company with Ballmer, who's I don't think Gates is Jewish, there are certainly some big-time, huge wealth. And now Facebook, of course, with Zuckerberg.
How do you see the political issue playing out in the future? Do you believe that is he worried about there being a political conflict between Jews and Asians?
Siegel? I don't think so. I mean, he noted that both Jews and Asians are voting for the Democratic Party. I don't think he sees them as really that different. And I don't either. I think that Asians are a threat to whites because you're not going to have whites, really represented to the extent they have been in technical areas. And if you look at elite institutions and education and universities, like in California, which is 14% Asian, while the University of California at Berkeley, which is the most elite University of California school, that's 43% Asian. And there's some of the campuses are way more than that, like University of California at Irvine is well over that. I forget the exact percentage. I wouldn't be surprised with 60% Asian. So there are huge inroads by Asians, but you know, every seat that an Asian has means that a white is not there anymore. And so whites are underrepresented, according to population statistics, in the University of California. Whites are underrepresented in Ivy League universities because you've got like 20 to 25% Jewish representation. And then you've got, you know, huge representation, affirmative action for blacks and Mexicans. And you've got Asian competition. So whites are left out, and there's no affirmative action for them. And I think there is even discrimination against them. I mean, because Jews are overrepresented, even controlling for IQ suggests Jewish favoritism. In fact, I think Princeton went down as only 13% Jews, and like these Jewish activists were making this a scandal, you know, that Princeton must be anti-Semitic or something because Jews are only 13%. Well, you know, 13% is like five times the percentage of the population. Anything less than 20% is anti-Semitism. So that's the way it is. The group that's really sort of left out are white Americans.
You had an article on your website, The Occidental Observer. I don't think it may have been by you or it may have been by someone else, but it did go into the statistics from the Ivy League universities.
Yeah, that was an article by Edmund Conley that I cited, and it actually had a chart in there about representation at elite universities. You can see that the underrepresented group are white Americans. Overrepresented groups and Jews are way overrepresented at institutions like Harvard. The chart is so, for example, whites are almost 70% of the population, and they're like 20% of the students at Harvard. But Jews are like 2% of the population. They're like 22% of the population at Harvard. So that's the kind of thing that we see. And that those kind of – I also have an article, which I cite there in the Siegel article, where I show that that Jews are overrepresented at elite institutions even more than when you control – if you control for IQ, they're still overrepresented. So it suggests some favoritism. That is, if you suppose that Jews have an average IQ of 110, well, that predicts a certain level of representation, that they would be have more representation. You know, but the fact that they're only 2.5% of the population, you have to realize there's an awful lot of white people that are in those IQ ranges. And so you do expect Jews to be overrepresented, but not to the extent of, you know, that they're 20% is just really a huge percentage given their population percentage of about 2.5%.
So you with Siegel, you're saying his hostility that he has towards whites would far trump any concern he'd have about the rise of Asians,
even if Asians were
hypothetically going to displace the Jews.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, actually, another case is in Europe where Jewish organizations have been very much in favor of Muslim immigration, despite the fact that Muslims have often been very anti-Jewish. I mean, there are areas of Europe now where Jews can't go anymore because the Muslims are so hostile. Like, for example, Malmo in Sweden, certain areas of France, very hostile towards Jews because of Israel and the whole thing. But the Jewish community still wants, you know, immigration from these countries. And I think they do think that ultimately the threat of Muslim Europe is much less than they really want to see the end of European Christian civilization. And so when they see this all this Muslim immigration, they see the Muslims are so aggressive, that's nothing but good, you know, and so they want that, even though individual Jews may suffer. And, you know, some Jews are leaving France, going to Israel because of all this. But, you know, that's not the end of the world for Jews. I mean, they've often moved out of areas that are anti-Jewish.
Are you talking about the majority of Jews or mainly just the leadership?
Well, the majority of Jews probably reflect the Jewish leadership. But in Europe, there is some, you know, there are certainly Jews in Europe that are concerned about Muslim immigration, just as in America you have people like Daniel Pipes, who are very, very critical of Muslims. And, and generally neocons are very critical of Muslims and Muslim immigration. But, you know, they you know, the interesting, even Pipes wants Muslim immigration. He's not opposed to Muslim immigration, but he just wants to tame the Muslims. He wants to make them less aggressive and less hostile and less anti-Jewish, certainly. And so in general, I think the organized Jewish community, this is true of Abe Foxman, the ADL, and all these people, they want Muslim immigration, but they want a sort of housebroken version of Muslim. They don't want it to be gung-ho anti-Israel. They don't want it to be, you know, so aggressive that it alienates everybody in Europeans. They want it to, you know, keep a fairly low profile, at least while they're a minority.
With Asians, you say that the Asians have traditionally not had a primal animus against white America.
No, they haven't. And one of the things I did do some studying on is the overseas Chinese in Indonesia and Southeast Asia, because you have all these overseas Chinese communities. In general, they kept a very low profile. They were often hated by the natives because they were so successful in business. And so they would have to protect themselves. But they didn't try to produce what I call a culture of critique, you know, the title of my book. They didn't, you know, seize the media and start attacking the culture of the natives. Did not happen. So even though there was some hostility towards the Chinese because they were so successful and all that, you didn't have the Chinese community kept a low profile. They did not, you know, engage in all this cultural criticism as you see as Jews have in the West. So it's a very different ballgame. But I do make the caveat in the article that in multicultural America here, these non-white groups are encouraged to be aggressive. That certainly would not be the case in Asia, in Southeast Asia. You know, if the Chinese minority was really aggressive and they were, you know, throwing down the religion or attacking the religion of the inhabitants the way Jews have attacked Christianity and the symbols of Christianity in the public square in this country, there'd be a huge outrage. But in this country, you know, this is sort of par for the course now. Multiculturalism almost demands that you can keep on to your own religion. That Christianity has no special place in America, that white people have no special place in America. And, you know, that the Asians in the end, I think, are going to go along with that ideology. I mean, they're voting with the Democratic Party. That means that they see themselves as part of this non-white group, this rising minority. They're not really voting their economics, because so many of these people are middle class or upper middle class. They're sort of like Jews. Jews vote Democrat. Even though they're making all this money and they're so, so successful, they vote Democrat because they see that party as the party of non-white America, the party of the left, the cultural left, gay marriage and all this stuff.
The two things to point out is the Jewish stereotype is that the main focus is on the making money, but you think that the ethnic issues, ethnic conflicts, trump the economic issues.
Well, certainly, in general, the Jewish community has done very, very well. They are the single most wealthy group in this country by far, and they have gravitated to high income professions like the financial industry. An awful lot of Jewish entrepreneurs, businessmen, and so on. They're very controlled, huge companies. And 35% of the billionaires in this country are Jewish. So that's, you know, they're overrepresented as billionaires by a factor of 17 or something like, or 15 or something. So it's massive overrepresentation.
I think it's a misconception. The other thing I want to point out, that the Democrats are, a lot of times that people, Republicans like to say that the Democrats want to play class warfare against the rich. That's a total misconception. If you look at how Obama's top source of donations was from Goldman Sachs.
Oh, yeah. That's one of the things. You know, and I have these arguments with people I know who are liberal. And from their point of view, you know, the Republican Party is the party of fat cats and all that. And the Democrats are the poor little guys. It's ridiculous. Jews provide like 75% of the money for the Democratic Party. An awful lot of huge corporations given by the Democratic Party. Hollywood is notorious for donating to the Democratic Party. The financial industry, supported Obama to the hilt in 2008. I understand that Goldman Sachs is now more in favor of Romney, but I suspect that's because they see Romney as no big threat, and they see him as better when it comes to regulating Wall Street. Because, there's a movement in Congress because of the huge crisis and the disaster that unfolded after 2008 to put more clamps on Wall Street. Wall Street doesn't like that, of course.
Do you see if any movement that sort of emerges in the future that's any kind of alternative? I think it is important to take a more sort of a populist stance on these issues like having to do with Wall Street than the sort of the watered down message of the Tea Party, which is sort of apologetic for those types.
Yeah, the Tea Party certainly was an interesting movement. I mean, it really, I think, represented some genuine anger. But then it got channeled into, they couldn't really raise issues like immigration. They were terrified of being called a racist. I remember I went to a couple of Tea Party things down here in Southern California, and they were always taking pains to have a black speaker or a Mexican speaker. You know, they didn't want to have any possibility that they would be considered racist. It hardly mattered because the media called them a bunch of racists anyway. But that's the perception, and that's the reality, that people are so afraid of being called a racist, so afraid of violating these canons of political correctness that they're just powerless. So then the result is that they end up getting frustrated because they're angry, but they don't have any real focus of their anger, and they don't really know what to do besides, well, maybe call for small government, or maybe lower the tax burden or something, I don't know what they want. So it becomes, unless you start talking, my view is we have to start talking about white issues explicitly. That's why I've associated myself with the American Third Position, a political party. We are explicitly in favor of white America. We're opposed to immigration. We're opposed to giving up our sovereignty and foreign policy to Israel and things like that. My belief is we have to be explicit, and we have to make this message that it's okay to be explicit, reasonable and okay. We can't we got to stop this fear of being called a racist and stand up and say we have interests like everybody else. I mean, every other group organizes in this country except white people. You're white and you organize, you have to pretend it has nothing to do with being white. And so I'm trying to, make it legitimate to talk about it in public and make people aware of it, because right now they're not. You talk to 95% of Americans, and of white Americans, they'd be horrified at the thought that white people should organize on the basis of white identity and white interests. But, there's nothing wrong with it, and we're just intimidated by this elite that will call you names and do what they can to ruin your livelihood, and they will try to make you lose your job and everything else. It's brutal out there, but they see it as, they portray themselves as these moral people when they're trying to get people fired for pursuing their legitimate interests. It's just horrendous to see what's going on here.
Are they still trying to threaten your job, or is that not as much of an issue anymore?
Well, they try. They tried recently. They tried in 2000, a three-year campaign to get me fired, but there's no way. The only way they'd get me fired is if I was I teach a child psychology course, and I go in there and start talking about Jewish influence on foreign policy. I mean, that's not appropriate. They could fire me if I did that. So they can't fire me for writing what I've written or that sort of thing. And then recently, the Southern Poverty Law Center claimed that I made all these false statements about Trayvon Martin, but they shut up pretty fast when I defended my point of view, and it never became an issue at the university, even though they explicitly said I should be fired for that. That was just a few months ago with Trayvon Martin.
But I think you said something like people have came in, or students have kind of tried to disrupt your classroom.
Yeah, that happened a couple times, one semester in particular. They came to my three classes, and they go in there and they talk to the students and tell them I was evil and all that. And I, you know, I'd have to sit there and deal with it. And there was no protection. I think the university, if they had known, they probably would have come and tried to do something, because what the students were doing was completely illegal. You can't just go in and disrupt a class like that. And you know, a couple of students left because of that. Well, that's fine. Yeah, I have fewer students. I have less work. It didn't bother me. But most of the students are sort of amazed and moved on. But that I'd have to say it was one of the most difficult things, though, psychologically. And that's what they try to do. They try to make your life as miserable as possible, even if they can't get you fired, because this is your sort of face-to-face world. You know, you're in there. It's one thing to go in there. Nobody, students don't really know what you're into, and they don't care and all that. But then when suddenly they come to your class and you're going on like that, it's very difficult to deal with that.
So the main thing is not so much the harassment, but it does create a sort of awkward environment.
Very, very awkward environment. And for those 3 years, 4 years when they were really going after them, the Southern Poverty Law Center came on campus. They stirred up the faculty. I mean, there'd be days I get on my computer and I have like 30 email messages on the faculty email list that were just going off on me. Just really a lot of just pure insult and name calling. And then some people trying to make arguments, and then I would answer them. And so was like a full-time job just answering these people and dealing with the hostility. So then you got to go in and teach your classes, and people won't look at you. They won't talk to you. They won't give you any decent committee assignments. You completely lose all your power in the department. You have no say anymore. And it's you know, that's part for the course. That's what the Southern Poverty Law Center does. They're unethical. They have no interest in the truth. All they care about is pursuing their political agenda. You have to expect that. But it's very difficult psychologically to deal with it at a personal level. That's the hardest part. But I'm used to it now, and I don't care. And I think last couple of years has been pretty easy. I mean, I don't go in there dreading it anymore. People talk to me sometimes. They're not as hostile as they used to be, and I think maybe some of them admire me for standing up to this crap. We'll see.
And there was a recent article about you in the OC Weekly in Orange County.
Well, it's the Orange County Register, which is a big newspaper. It's the biggest newspaper in Orange County. Probably one of the 7 million people in Orange County. It's a huge county, so it's a big newspaper. It didn't get that much traction, though. It was embedded in a series about hate groups in Orange County and all that. So I was sort of thrown in with all of them. But I thought in general that the article was good. It had a lot of quotes from me, and I thought in general was the better, probably the best piece I've seen in the media about me. Because in general, what their standard thing is to take a couple quotes, and then they go to the Southern Poverty Law Center or this civil rights organization. So all this bill is a civil rights organization. You're right. These guys really care about civil rights. And they'll quote, Mark Potok or Heidi Beirich, who can reliably be expected to say something very bad about me. But in this article, they really did some good things. I mean, they let me sort of give my say that white people have an identity and then that they should be allowed to, and that's entirely legitimate and other groups do it. And those kind of ideas got in there. And I think, I also talked about Jews in the article. They left those quotes in. I said Jews are a very powerful group and so on, and we should be able to discuss them like we talk about other groups. And so I thought it was beneficial overall. You know, and it could be that it didn't get much traction because people didn't want it to have traction. They thought it was too positive in a sense, that it was too even-handed. They don't really want that kind of thing.
Professor Kevin McDonald, I'd like to thank you for being on the show.
I enjoyed it. I always enjoy being here, Robert, anytime you want me.
That's all we have for tonight's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.